Welcome back to The Ownership Economy. In this week's episode, we connect with Nick Dukoff, currently a partner at G20 Ventures. Nick started his journey as an attorney and quickly shifted into entrepreneurship. We discuss his learnings as an entrepreneur, investor, and DAO contributor, and how these roles have impacted his view on creating value. As Nick is currently investing in ventures in the ownership economy, entrepreneurs and investors will be particularly interested in this episode. Nick will also be in Austin for South by Southwest 2023 through Monday, if you would like to meet him. If you're interested in other takes on investing in this market, we suggest you check out episode 21 with Julia Lipton from Awesome People Ventures.
Hey, Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we like to start out our podcast learning a little bit about your background. You've been kind of an investor, an entrepreneur. You're now a fairly prolific DAO contributor. Can you walk us through your background and origin story?
Sure. So I was born in Houston, Texas, a mecca for technology startups. No, just kidding. But I was very lucky because I had my parents were, you know, very generous, and I had very early access to computers and the internet in the 90s. And so started hacking around on the internet very early and really took to it, and started getting into entrepreneurship when I was in college at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Started my first company when I was in law school at the University of Texas. Thought about dropping out. The dean talked me out of it. I'm very glad, because I ended up practicing venture capital law, which got me even closer to technology companies and venture capitalists. I worked on deals like the MySpace acquisition by Fox, which was really cool at the time. And then the joke I make is entrepreneurship looks so easy that I quit my very high paying, you know, a prestigious law firm job to go start a company. My parents and everyone else thought I was crazy, but, you know, knock on wood, luckily it worked out. We sold that company to DXC, which is a public company, and then did more startups over the following decade. And last year, I joined G20 Ventures, and now I'm a VC.
Awesome. So you've had kind of these experiences as an entrepreneur, as kind of a life as an investor, and you've also more recently been a DAO contributor. I want to segment this interview in those three areas, because I think that each role probably contributes to helping you be better in the other roles. And so maybe we could start out by talking a little bit about the two companies you founded, InfoChips and Edmit, and just tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. So InfoChips was an early big data company. So we actually started it as a data marketplace. The idea was, hey, there's a lot of data that companies may have that they want to monetize, and there are other companies that may want access to that data. AWS was fairly nascent at the time, but enabled us to be able to both store and, you know, process data at scale fairly inexpensively, really for the first time ever. But the market wasn't really ready for a data marketplace. And so we took the infrastructure we had built to store, to send, to query data, and we began marketing that as an enterprise solution to companies. And that ended up working. We were one of Amazon's kind of early, fairly large customers. You know, we had many terabytes of data, which at the time was large for the cloud. Now, you know, petabytes would be large for the cloud. And a lot has changed since then. And I'm really happy to see that other folks have taken our initial vision, the data marketplace, and are building on that, like Brett Hurt at data.world.
Cool. And then you went on to Edmit. Maybe we could talk a little bit, about Edmit just quickly, and then we'll talk about kind of your experience and the trajectory of each of the startups, because I think that'll be helpful for a better understanding how you approach startups now as an investor. But what did Edmit do?
Yeah. So Edmit helped high school families understand college affordability. So, you know, we hear a lot about people having, you know, too much student debt. Well, how did they get there? they got there because nobody was really helping them understand and plan financially for post-secondary education in the way that you would any other large financial decision, like planning for buying a house or saving for retirement. And if you look at the magnitude of the investment, higher education, at least in the United States, is $100,000 to $200,000, is not dissimilar to, you know, a retirement at nest egg or, you know, a small first home. And yet there's no preparation, no planning for it, you know, largely whatsoever. And so our software helped families understand and students understand, you know, what was possible for them and taking into account what they plan to study and what their likely career options were following that.
And so in that kind of decade of being an entrepreneur, if you could pass on a couple of nuggets of wisdom that came out of that, that were kind of learnings that, I mean, it's, you know, a decade of entrepreneurship, there's probably, you know, 1,000 things you learned, but like things that you just didn't expect that you wish you had known when you were getting started, that now that when you're making investments, you kind of have that in the back of your mind.
Yeah. So I was also fortunate. Last year, I got to teach entrepreneurship at the college level in Rome, Italy, not too far from you guys, at John Cabot University. And, you know, the thing that I really wanted the students to take away and what I want all founders to take away is that you've got to be super close to the customer. You know, the Lean Startup by Eric Ries is my Bible, build, measure, learn, and really tightening that feedback loop and making sure that you're building something that customers want and you're being honest with yourself about what the data says about, you know, how important your product is to them. You know, there's like a Rahul Vora's kind of from Superhumans kind of classic thing of if this product disappeared, you know, how upset would you be? And I think that kind of framework is fundamentally important because at the end of the day, all successful companies, the thing they all have in common is that, you know, customers love their products, right? You know, for, you know, consumer companies, that may mean, you know, they use them all the time. For enterprise products, that means they paid a lot of money for them, right? Or paid very consistently over long periods of time.
Cool. So I think that's, you know, so important and so hard to get. People kind of spend so much time working on the product and not launching and not getting kind of customer feedback. And then they spend all their seed round and, you know, they, you know, never get through this kind of the seed to series A chasm, right? One of the things that I think is particularly interesting about your path is that you're now on the other side as an investor and you have to think through exit from kind of day one as you're making these investments. And at least in my own experience as an entrepreneur, you know, the first time that I went through an exit, I wasn't ever thinking about exit in my first venture. I now think about it all the time. It's just a different frame of mind because you're building something that's kind of your baby and you don't want to give it up. And so I'm wondering, to the extent that you can talk about the exits in these two ventures, how were they structured? You know, did they go well? I asked as I was actually an investor in Vimo Education, which I think bought Edmit. And so I lost my money. So I'm kind of interested from the entrepreneur perspective, you know, what did these two kind of going through building these companies and then exiting kind of teach you and what was surprising for you?
Yeah, sure. So the InfoChimps acquisition was all cash. So that was easy. You know, even if it had been all stock, it was public company. So we could have taken and sold it, you know, had we wanted to. The lesson in the first company was the founders collectively, and there were four of us, you know, didn't own very much of the company at exit. And there's a number of reasons for that, including it took us a while to really find, you know, that product that customers wanted to pay for and, you know, really wanted to use. And, you know, I'm just very happy that we did find that product market fit and, you know, we're able to have a fairly good exit. But I wish we had found it sooner, right? It would have been a lot less dilutive to us had we not needed, you know, the additional capital to, you know, continue, you know, hacking away through the thick forest to find that product market fit. And then with respect to Edmit, that was, you know, an interesting situation. You know, we closed on the acquisition in April of 2021, which if you look, you know, back in time, that was probably among, you know, one of the best few months in the past 10 years to sell a company. I mean, you know, we got out at the right time. And we sold the company in part because we recognized that even though we had a lot that was working, and you know, we did have you know, fairly decent revenue and customers that loved us on both sides of the transaction, we had a kind of a two-sided business where we had student users and we had corporate payers. So there was kind of two stakeholders we had to please who needed to be happy with what we were building. That made it a little more complicated, but we didn't really see like how we were going to 10, 20X revenue from where we were. You know, we had pretty clear sights on how we could grow it, you know, nominally, you know, maybe double it, triple it, but we didn't really see how we were going to 10X it from where we were. And so our options were, you know, raise more capital, you know, pivot a little bit, you know, add an additional product or some other new business line to, you know, expand our TAM, you know, or sell the company. And we didn't run a process. The opportunity came inbound, and my co-founder Sabrina and I, you know, looked at it, tried to look at it unemotionally and look at what we thought was best for all of our stakeholders, you know, specifically our investors, ourselves, our employees, and, you know, the future for our customers as well. And we thought that was the best decision with the information we had at that time. You know, without getting into details, part of the consideration was in cash and part was in stock. I'm very happy that part was in cash. I wish it was all in cash. You know, I think there are, and this is just something also philosophically now, even as a VC, is it's pretty rare where you prefer stock, you know, at exit, because, you know, as an investor now, you know, when you sell one of your portfolio companies, you then need to make a decision about how you distribute the proceeds of that to your LPs. And LPs don't want to be holding private illiquid securities, and they want cash. They want DPI, right? So, you know, even if we had an IPO in one of our portfolio companies, we would probably sell and distribute cash versus distribute stock, because that's ultimately what investors want. They don't want to have to make a, by the way, it's like selling a stock is an investment decision, just like buying one is. And investors don't want to have to think about, well, is $100 a share a fair price for Airbnb or whatever? Like, you know, most people aren't equipped to kind of evaluate that unless they have to be public market investors or something like that, which few RLPs are.
Yeah, I can definitely echo that too, in that, you know, I just having set up a fund, my first fund as an emerging manager, that, you know, people are like, oh, are you going to hold tokens? Are you going to hold equity? How are we going to get disbursements? All these really complicated questions. And the simplest way to answer it is like cash in, cash out, right? Like, and we'll get it to you on a 7-year timeline or whatever. And we have a little bit of a, you know, fudging, like room to fudge that because we have tokens. And if you would like liquid distributions, we can do that, right? But completely agree. It's exactly what we see on our side.
Maybe you guys could just explain DPI, given the breadth of the audience.
Sure, that is distributions to paid in capital. So if I put $100 in and I get $200 back, that would be a 2x DPI.
Cool. So you had these kind of entrepreneurial experiences. One, you both exited, different outcomes based on the preference stack, how much you raised, kind of what you got from cash versus equity, what happened after you got the equity. I mean, just so people understand, in the second exit, I think FEMO still exists, or did it shut down? I don't remember. I got a notice as an investor that it wasn't worth anything, but I don't think it shut down, right? Is that what happened, or did it actually shut down?
It's still operating. It's still operating, yeah.
Okay. So you now are on the flip side of this, but you're coming at it from a, really as an operator, right, for most of your career. And so how has that impacted how you how you approach being an investor?
Yeah, I mean, so we try to be very aligned with our founders, and we tell them like, hey, and this is part because of the structure of our fund. We have a, you know, fairly modest size fund in the grand scheme of things. We're on our fourth fund. We just closed, did a first close on our fourth fund. Each of our funds are about $60 million. And we are post-seed investors. So our first check tends to be $3 to $5 million. And so, you know, if you're doing the math, you know, we invest in, call it 15 or so companies per fund. And we don't have the ability to follow on in the same way that Bessemer and Drayson Horowitz, you know, these firms, these great firms with kind of unlimited capital. So our dollars really mean a lot. Those first dollars in really mean a lot. We want that. We want to maintain as much ownership as we can. And so are looking for capital efficient businesses and founders who want to run their businesses in a way that, even if they go on to raise, you know, significantly more capital, are doing so at an increasingly high, you know, valuation so that it's, you know, minimally dilutive over time. And I think that aligns us very closely with our founders' interests because, you know, we can't keep buying and kind of averaging, you know, over time the way that some investors are able to do. We're more like the founders where we get diluted over time. And so we really want to find founders that want to own as much of their company as possible at exit and want, you know, the biggest outcome for them that is possible. And I think we all win when that's the case. And this also was kind of drilled into me by Eric Paley from Founder Collective, who invested in two of my startups. You know, they, you know, always say they try to be the most aligned investor at the seed stage. And we have a very similar approach to how we work with founders.
Interesting. And would you recommend that a founder takes a check from VC that doesn't have any partners that were entrepreneurs?
Well, I think there's phenomenal professional investors out there. You know, someone that I, you know, like hold in the highest esteem is Kent Bennett at Bessemer. And Kent is a professional investor. I don't think he was a founder of a startup. And, you know, he's made incredible investments and all the founders that have worked with him, including myself, you know, think he's incredible as a advisor and mentor and thought partner. So I don't, you know, of course, I think it's helpful to have had that operational experience. If you haven't had that operational experience, you need to have had a lot of experience as a VC, you know, and hopefully some success that you're able to disambiguate between skill and luck, right? I think a lot of professional VCs who have not had operational experience, you know, maybe they make an early investment and it turns out to be fantastic and can't really disambiguate whether that was just, you know, dumb luck or, you know, really because of some skill, you know, whether that skill in pipeline, skill in winning, skill in supporting, you know, the many skills that good VCs have to have to provide above market returns consistently over time to their investors. That's when I find founders get frustrated is when, you know, they have investors who can't relate to them, think they know all the answers, but, you know, haven't really seen enough to relate to them.
Interesting. And in the decision to become a VC, right, and kind of go to the other path, what drove that? What was the motivating factor in that?
Yeah, so I had been an angel investor since I sold my first startup and, you know, kind of became an accredited investor or whatever. And I have just, it's been so rewarding to be an angel investor. I love all of, you know, the founders that I've had the opportunity to work with. And boy, do I spend a disproportionate amount of my time with them relative to my teeny tiny check size. And it's been just incredibly fun to watch these founders build, you know, fantastic companies over time. And I loved being a founder myself. I wouldn't trade my experiences for anything. I'm so glad I took the risks that I did and learned the hard way, right? By just doing it. But now at this point in my career, after selling Edmit, you know, I did a lot of introspection. I worked with a coach and I thought about, you know, what do I really want to be when I grow up? I'm 42, by the way. So I'm you know, not a spring chicken.
40s are the new 20s, right?
Yeah, 40s are the new 30s, exactly. And you know, all roads came to being a VC. I mean, it was like very clear, you know, when I really did the work that this is what I wanted to do. And I'm just so fortunate that the G20 team took a risk on me and brought me into the partnership.
That's awesome. It's hard to continue at the pace of a founder, right? As well. I mean, the VCs have a hard life, and you got to raise that LP money and deploy it, but it's not the same.
I like to always say that no one should feel sorry for us, but I would like to point out that 40% year over year dip in LP distributions from 2021 to 2022. it's getting tough for everybody. But our lives are really good. This job is awesome, right? Like, no one should break out the tiny violin for us.
Yeah, it's a privilege to be a VC for sure.
So as a recruiter for your own startups and now as a VC, how important was the core team?
Oh, I mean, I'd say founders and core team is everything. I actually increasingly put a disproportionate amount of weight on the CEO founder. I think founding team is really, really important, but I'm really trying to understand, you know, the motivations of the CEO, their management approach, you know, their why, you know, and also like who they are as people. I think it's really important to have someone with a steady hand at the till. Because I talk about the startup sine curve, you know, the highs are high and the lows are low. And if, you know, you don't know how to manage those both internally for yourself, as well as making sure that the team doesn't feel the gyrations as wide, like you really got to bring, you know, that curve in, both for yourself and for the team, because nobody wants to feel like they're on a rocking ship. Right. And so I think team is incredibly important. Founders are incredibly important. And the CEO is the most important.
Okay. And now you are spending a lot of time in DAOs, which are decentralized autonomous organizations, right? And so do DAOs have that quality of a strong core leader? Do they have kind of strong core teams? Like if they don't, how do DAOs create value?
Well, I think if you look at like the best performing DAOs, they are, you know, pretty kind of founder leader led. You know, John Hillis at Cabin, Commodore and the team at Kraus. The team at Seed Club is the core team's pretty small and tight there. And they lead from within, but then bring others in as well. You know, the most kind of decentralized of the DAOs, I think, have had more of a problem. You know, look at like a SushiSwap or something like that, where if the core team doesn't stay intact and, you know, kind of with clear vision and leadership, the rest crumbles pretty fast.
So then if there's a core team that is responsible for making sure, or kind of a core leader with the team around them, or charismatic leader that's responsible for making sure that the DAO continues. What's the difference between a DAO and a company?
Yeah, well, so I am more interested in DAOs as digital autonomous organizations rather than decentralized autonomous organizations. I think, you know, the way I think about it is like, it's a group with a, you know, with a wallet. You know, it's a group with a treasury. Like at the end of the day, a digital group with a treasury, that's a DAO. And, you know, there's all sorts of groups of people that you want to collaborate that are not, you know, physically, you know, contemporaneous, that may not be able or want to have a bank account for any variety of reasons. And DAOs really enable a whole new way of collaborating with a shared treasury that was really difficult before. And so I'm like super bullish on DAOs, you know, as digital autonomous organizations, as decentralized autonomous organizations. I think we'll get there. And I think, you know, a lot of the DAOs that I mentioned, you know, are and will continue to decentralize over time, you know, this idea of progressive decentralization. But I think it's really important to have founders with a vision, core leadership team, even if folks come in and out of it, that, you know, kind of maintains that vision and propagates that vision.
And so what regulations do you think should apply to that core team? We have Commissioner Peirce coming on in 2 to 3 weeks from the SEC to talk about how the SEC is approaching this. Like, and if the team isn't in, if the team's spread across different countries, like how should, if you've been an investor, you know how important that core team is. You also know that the Howey test kind of applies to a lot of these securities. Like what's the balance here? What's the best way to set this up where you actually create value?
Well, so there's a whole bunch of things, right? So one is like, let's just talk about income. Well, there's kind of a couple things here. There's like income and there's securities. And then there's like all sorts of other local, state, and federal laws that can apply to, you know, organizations of various kinds, but, you know, maybe we can talk about them in that order. First is income. Like if you're working for a DAO and you're getting paid, whether that's in, you know, USDC or equivalent or liquid tokens that have some pecuniary value, like you can swap them, you know, on a DEX, you need to report that income. Like, and, you know, I'd argue that DAOs should, you know, try to comply with the jurisdictions in which, you know, they're providing income. I don't see what exemption they would have, nor do I see why they should have an exemption, right? If you're providing compensation to someone, that person should be reporting that income in whatever jurisdiction they're required to report that income, right? By the way, you'll find that as somebody who's like a very high risk taker, who is like at the edges of, you know, DAOs and Web3 and has always been pushing the edges of the internet, I actually am pretty pragmatic when it comes to the law. Maybe that's because I'm a lawyer. But I do also fundamentally believe in rule of law and, you know, compliance with regulations and legislation, even if I don't agree with them. Okay. So I just want to put that out there. But so the second is like securities. And, you know, if you're doing what are clearly fundraising activities with your token, like if you're saying, hey, you know, I've got 1,000 tokens, I'm going to sell 100 of those tokens, and that's going to fund my treasury. And, you know, there's the expectation that we're going to use that treasury to increase the total value of, you know, the DAO and thus the individual 1,000 tokens in that DAO. That's a security. That's security. I don't know under what definition it wouldn't be. And there's all sorts of exemptions, by the way, to securities laws, right? You know, have them only be sold to accredited investors, make the appropriate Form D filings, you know, or comply with any of the other many blue sky exemptions that, you know, the US government has with respect to securities. I'm not as familiar as other countries' securities laws. You know, or if you're a DAO, you're more of like a group of friends or, you know, not looking to have this be as broadly held, you know, then it's probably maybe not a security. If, you know, you and your friends are doing something together and you're each investing in it together, you know, that's cool. You can pool money together and increase the value of that money by doing things. And that doesn't make it a security, right? And then the last thing is like, you know, the compliance with the other litany of laws. Like, for example, like in Massachusetts, we have a personal property tax, which is somewhat unusual. Companies have to attest to what they own, the value of what they own, computers, desks, whatever. And then they have to pay a state tax, in some cases, municipal tax on that personal property. If a DAO is operating in Massachusetts or some significant portion of it is, you know, perhaps those laws apply to them. I don't know, but I don't think just by being a DAO, you are like magically exempt from like all the laws. And a lot of DAOs, I think, operate as if they are.
Interesting. Okay. So maybe we can switch gears. I think that was a really good kind of overview. on how kind of someone who's involved at a fairly significant level should treat the law when they're in the DAO. They should probably adhere to it, or at least be cognizant of what the law is, right?
And like a Boston DAO, you know, another DAO I'm a part of, you know, we've been very cognizant of, you know, doing everything by the books from the get-go. And I think that that's going to put us in a really good position, you know, to continue to grow the organization over time and to do it in a way that everyone feels comfortable with.
What is Boston DAO?
Yeah, so right now Boston DAO is a group of Boston fans. You don't have to be based in Boston. So I know Martin, you're a Boston fan. So you could be a member of Boston DAO. Who is
fans of the city or fans of the Red Sox or fans of,
you know, listen, if you've ever had Dunkin' Donuts, you could be a member of Boston DAO.
You know, we somehow have Dunkin' Donuts in Barcelona. I don't know how it came.
We do.
I guess it's a franchise, but it's ridiculous so that it's here. So, yeah.
And Martin lives in between them too.
City DAO then, you know, Barcelona DAO. We should shake hands.
There's a Catalan DAO.
All right. Awesome. I love it. Yeah. And I'm a big fan of the Austin DAO, which is kind of got a very similar agenda as Boston DAO. Listen, we're just trying to get a great group of people together that wants to, you know, coordinate a treasury to, you know, build the Web3 ecosystem, you know, in and around Boston and for folks who love Dunkin' Donuts.
Okay. Interesting. You know, I worked at Dunkin' Donuts. I worked in Dunkin' Donuts when I was 15. I actually got fired from Dunkin' Donuts. It's the only job I've ever been fired from. But I fell asleep on the counter and actually juggled donuts on camera. It's a different experience. Anyway, so in Boston DAO, in these DAOs that you participate in, how do people earn income? How do you deal with token investing? Like, what influence does your role as a VC bring to how you think about token investing, how you think about marginal value creation within a DAO? Like talk a little bit about that. Like, as we're building the ownership economy, how do people get paid? How do they contribute value over time?
Yeah. So the way that I think that I've seen it done a variety of ways, but the way that I think it works best is, and this is more for, there's like, let's just call it two sets of groups. And this is an oversimplification, but there's like core, and then there's kind of, you know, everyone else. And within the everyone else category, folks may contribute, you know, value to the DAO in ways that should be compensated. And, you know, those are known as like bounties in the DAO world, which is, hey, we need somebody to design a logo for us. Okay, somebody, you know, may go do that and come back and we approve it. Great. You know, Boston DAO, awesome. Here's, you know, a couple hundred bucks or whatever. And then there's the core team who is putting in, you know, some expected amount of work per, you know, unit of time, call it a month, for some duration, you know, call it a season, which is the kind of term in DAOs. And, you know, that's different for different DAOs, maybe a quarter, maybe half of a year, maybe a year, whatever, however long the season is. And, their compensation usually for the core team is a mix of USDC, you know, or similar stablecoin and the native token of the DAO. And, you know, everyone has a different situation. And like, I certainly think it's very important for DAOs to be inclusive. I'm actually really a huge proponent of giving folks the choice and that it not be seen as not like being as committed to the DAO if you want USDC instead of the DAO token, because people need to put food on the table. And not everybody's in the position to take, you know, what might be in a liquid, you know, in a liquid token that may or may not even have any value at the time in order to do work. So usually, you know, it's say, hey, here's the range and there's a sliding scale between this much USDC and this many tokens. And you set, you know, yourself wherever along that sliding scale that feels right for you.
Cool. We're always trying to think through kind of how to optimize that. We've had a number of different entrepreneurs come on that are creating tooling around community management, around ownership. Around like how to optimize, you know, not giving away too much of your company or your DAO, how to kind of roll out things. So it's always interesting to hear it from an investor perspective or someone who's got kind of both hats. What are the themes you're most, you're going to South by Southwest on this weekend. What are the themes you're most excited about? What are the types of startups you're most excited about? What are you hoping to invest in crypto winter or wherever we are today with kind of this macroeconomic environment that's kind of crushed a lot of the ecosystem? What are you guys thinking about both as an individual investor and with the firm?
Yeah. So at G20, we are post-seed investors. Our checks are usually $3 to $5 million. We are predominantly B2B focused. And we typically like to see something that's showing signs of working. And what that means for us is usually, you know, product and market, customers, and some revenue. We don't have hard and fast rules as to, you know, how much that revenue needs to be, but we need to see, you know, in the data that something is clearly starting to work. And we want to be the first firm to see that and, you know, really give, you know, meaningful capital beyond the seed stage. Within Web3, you know, there's a lot of different approaches. I think, frankly, like we're so early in the cycle that I think almost every business is ultimately going to be disrupted by the technologies and or philosophies of Web3. And we're at the very earliest stages of this. So I want to see any company that's leveraging the technologies or philosophies of Web3, that's, you know, blockchain, smart contracts, DAOs, in order to disrupt, you know, incumbent businesses that are selling something to other businesses. And I define business kind of broadly. So for instance, like if I'm an Airbnb host and I own, you know, multiple properties that I rent out, like that's a business, right, to me. On the other end, you know, we do love enterprise businesses, you know, companies that are selling to Fortune 500 companies with, you know, $100,000 plus ACVs. I love those too. But I think that, you know, even the definition of what is a business, going back to our conversation about DAOs a few minutes ago, is broadening.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to also, we just jumped right into this, but Nick, I wanted to kind of ask you, it's funny to ask this question. We're on a podcast called The Ownership Economy, but I'm curious to know, what is your definition of it?
Yeah, so I think that your stakeholders need to be invested in the organization's success. And, you know, I think a lot about like John Mackey, the founder of Whole Foods, and he was really kind of quite revolutionary in his thinking. I can't even remember the name of his book, but it was something, you know, about stakeholders being broader than shareholders was the real takeaway. And, you know, a lot of corporate governance folks derided that and, you know, said, no, the goal of a corporation is to, you know, maximize shareholder value, full stop, not stakeholder value. And I think, you know, he was right in hindsight, like 1000% right. And the organizations that recognize that, you know, there are a lot of interested stakeholders in an organization's success and find ways to incentivize and align those folks' interests, those are the companies that are going to win over time, in my opinion.
Awesome. So I think, like, you know, Martin is literally writing a PhD on parts of this, right? So we get into this here and there, especially here in Barcelona. So I think one thing I'm curious is your opinion on is, do you, just talking about the Web3 stuff, man, it's been a rough year and a half. And honestly, a lot of people are even just doubting the efficacy of these technologies to actually deliver on broad-based wealth distribution and inclusive governance, right? So like where you stand now with, you know, we kind of define the ownership economy, great example from Whole Foods. Do you think where we're at in Web3 now with blockchain and all that, that there's still real promise for the stakeholder inclusion and governance? Or do you, you know, just what is your perspective on that?
Yeah, my enthusiasm is undiminished. I'm as keen on this space as I was 18 months ago. And the builders are, you know, going to keep building. I think it's actually been probably like a net beneficial thing for Web3 and crypto to see all these failures, because like Listen, going back to the first question, which was, you know, what advice do you have for founders? And that's, you know, make sure that you're building something that customers want. Like there was a lot of three card money happening in the space. That is not durable, you know, customer, you know, value. And I think the folks that are building with kind of durable customer value in mind, are going to create incredible businesses that, you know, become household names like Uber, nice. Like Airbnb. We're going to have those businesses in the Web3 space, in the 2020s. You know, my timeline is maybe pushed out a little bit further than I thought. You know, if you had asked me 18 months ago, when would I have said I would think those names would start emerging, I would have said probably this year. Yeah. I think it's probably 2025, you know, that we'll have a household name where, you know, not just like trading crypto, but that, you know, folks that you're friends with that are not super technical are like, oh, I love the app. And it's like, app, and they may not even know it, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that too. I was out here in Barcelona at with lunch with two crypto founders and a VC, and our waiter saw his crypto.com card. He was like, oh, crypto, it's all in Spanish. Oh, crypto.com. Guys, what should we buy? Right. And that's kind of where we're at right now, right? Is like, what crypto should I buy and hold? Right. So that's totally true.
I can't tell you how many Ubers I've been in, and you know, the driver asks me that, and I'm just like, do not take my advice, DYOR, you know?
This is not like, investment advice, absolutely. Well, what you said, kind of before I get off the topic, what you said about advice for founders, just to really tie this together, I think from that thread and to where we were at on this ownership economy, do you as a VC now see a stark difference evolving in the way that founders think about their token cap tables and including their stakeholders versus how they would do it as equity, right? Because, you know, it's somewhat straightforward. We're in year 20 of like almost of the safe, right? So it's pretty straightforward. You got your safe, you got your price round, you got your ESOPs, you see that development over time, and you know who your stakeholders are. They're building the business, they're in-house, they're your investors, what have you. Do you see that changing substantially in this ownership economy context with tokens?
I you know, it depends. And it depends because in some of these court cases that have been you know, fully litigated, some courts are saying the more distributed the token, thus the more decentralized, the less, you know, a small group of people is controlling the decision making, the better it may be from a regulatory perspective. You know, where a small group of people are controlling the decisions, that again looks a lot like a company that should be, you know, held to, you know, those expectations. To the extent something is more fully distributed and decentralized, you know, that may make it a little more protected in some of the regulatory schemes that are out there. So there may be some legal strategic reasons to have, you know, more broadly held stakeholder participation of a token. It's still so early. I mean, you know, we don't know so much about how this is going to get treated. You know, Gary Gensler has made it very clear that he thinks everything except for Bitcoin is a security.
Right.
He seems to be very committed to seeing that through.
Yeah, it was really honestly more of a selfish question for a person who's been investing in this, you know, like yourself, has been investing in the space for quite a bit and now are also on the VC side. I'm wondering when I'm going to start seeing decks or stop seeing decks that say, like, you know, standard founder split, standard investor split, also 60% for the community, because, you know, we're trying to keep Gary Gensler off our backs, right? So wondering when we get to a little bit, when founders and their core contributors really start thinking, like, who, if I'm building Teleport, you know, like Uber for, you know, on chain, who is my stakeholder committee, and what do I really think the just even from a game theoretic perspective of some even not that complex, some kind of perspective that says, where's my starting point so that I maximize my learning and minimize the harms I'm going to institute by starting with X slice of the pie versus Y.
Yeah, I think there's another lever here, right? Which is just make who can hold a security a lot lower, right? I mean, because then that solves a lot of these problems, right? So the biggest issue here when we talk about the ownership economy is that the vast majority of Americans, the vast majority of people in the world don't have financial securities. When you have quantitative easing, you inflate asset prices, this leads to inequality, right? And so to the extent that you change the securities law in terms of what, who can hold a security, how you can market a security, what's the regulatory process around that, what are the blue sky laws? And this goes into kind of the token safe harbor work, right? That Commissioner Peirce will talk with us about. So that might be another lever as well. Because if it's not a security and it's not, I mean, there's so much that can go wrong in one of these ventures. I mean, and I'm interested to see what happens with like mergers, hostile takeovers, like what happens around kind of the traditional nastiness of business as this market kind of matures, right? Because in the reality, business is pretty cutthroat and competitive, and to the extent that we don't have these regulations and these laws and there's just not clarity, I think it makes it a lot harder to operate in a lot of ways. So,
I mean, listen, as an investor, both like kind of like retail investor in tokens and, you know, as a institutional investor, I do think about like, what does M&A look like in the token context? Like, you know, like you put it to a vote, you know, to the community, what do the bylaws say about what, you know, approval rate is necessary to, you know, have a sale of a company in Delaware? You know, that's a 2/3 threshold versus a simple majority. Okay, so then you go do it and it's consummated. What is there, like a kind of like a burn and swap kind of smart contract that it's like, okay, I then go and my 100, you know, whatever Boston Dow tokens, you know, Dunkin' Donuts is acquiring Boston Dow. So now I go, you know, to some claim page and, you know, my 100 Boston Dow tokens are burned and I'm given, you know, 100 shares of Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, how's it going to work? I'm not exactly sure. And I don't think there are a lot of examples of this having happened yet. So we'll see.
There's really just the one that I can think of, which is when Faye acquired Rari Capital, right? And that was a mess. And I'm every day I'm kind of just refreshing the Google News alerts to see like who's going to get wrecked by the SEC on this one, which we'll put in the show notes. It's a fascinating case.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time, Nick. This is awesome. Especially we know how I know from Jawhead how busy UVCs are with all your hard work. I'm looking forward to getting there one day. You know, for now I'm just toiling it out as an entrepreneur. Where can people follow you online? Where should people kind of stay on top of your work?
Yeah. So I'm at Nick Dukoff on Twitter, NICKDUCOFF. I'm at Stoic on Farcaster. And I am Nick@G20VC.com. And if you reach out to me, I will get back to you.
Thanks so much again.
Thank you for having me. Hope to meet you in person. Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Ownership Economy. Don't forget to like and subscribe.